You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today we're joined by the IEA's Research Director, Dr. Jamie White, and Catherine McBride, Senior Economist in the IEA's International Trade and Competition Unit, who analyze the future of Britain's financial services post-Brexit. Interviewed by Digital Officer Madeline Grant, the pair discussed to what extent Brexit will actually affect the vibrancy of the UK's financial services, and what opportunities lie outside of the European Union for the finance industries. Catherine and Jamie give particular focus to the fear-mongering perpetuated by certain camps around the future of financial services, arguing that the EU's regulatory fixations have held the City of London back for years and made it significantly harder for genuine competitors to enter the market. They also discuss a host of specific regulations, including MiFID II, which the UK can address once it's left the European Union. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
During the referendum campaign, we were told that there would be mass relocations of banks to Frankfurt and Paris and everywhere else. How much of this have we seen so far?
We've seen very little, and we will see very little. Some banks are increasing the number of staff they have overseas, but they're mainly hiring local people. There have never been a lot of cross-border banking in areas where it really matters that you have someone who speaks the local language incredibly well. So banks will be, if they're setting up an office in Frankfurt, they'll be hiring people from Frankfurt rather than moving English or American people from the UK. But wholesale banking has predominantly been in the UK, and we have no limits to people coming to us for money. In the same way that you would go to your high street bank to get a loan or a mortgage, you don't wait for the bank to come to you. That will still continue. The Bank of England has said that they'll allow banks who are already established here, European banks, to remain here in the same manner that they allow banks from all over the world to work out of London. And they're even going to allow European banks to remain as branches, even though most foreign banks will set up subsidiaries here, because a subsidiary is a better, safer way for the Bank of England, so that if the bank, the foreign bank, should go bankrupt or have some kind of difficulty, if it's a separate subsidiary here, we don't have to worry about that.
Let me add, because it may not be clear, that when you're a subsidiary, you need to have your own balance sheet in that country. So that would mean that the bank was capitalized in the UK, and that's why it's safer, because that capital would be there to be drawn upon should things go wrong. When it's a branch, as the name implies, it's just an office, so to speak, that you're operating out of, but the bank's balance sheet can be in its home country. And so one of the things that's going to change for British banks is that if they want to operate in European countries, they can't do it as branches anymore after Brexit. They'll have to set up subsidiaries. But that's not an especially big deal. That needn't be very expensive, and it needn't involve an enormous amount of staff. And so the movement of people from London over there, as Catherine said, you won't necessarily move, but I mean the shift in numbers of people, was never going to be that large. And it seems that the initial estimates of it, in fact, the most famous one was by my former employer, Oliver Wyman, they estimated, I think, 35,000 shift. They now seem to be a little over the top.
People are now saying it'll be less than 5,000 people, and that sounds about right, because there are many other things that are positive for banking in the UK besides our ability to sell into the EU. We're actually a global banking centre. We raise money for people all over the world. The EU doesn't. The tax environment in the UK is very pro-banks. It's not quite as pro-banks as it used to be, because the government has introduced a tax surcharge on banks particularly, but other financial businesses such as the asset managers will remain here. But at the moment, we have a small problem with this bank surcharge, because it puts our corporate taxes much closer to Germany and France than I think is really politic. If we had remained at the 19% tax rate, being 10 to 15% lower than most of the large cities in Europe, London had nothing to fear. And also our individual tax rates are lower. Our employment laws are more flexible and work better for most banks. And generally we have a whole environment works for banking. We have lawyers here. The ecostructure, that's the word. The ecology of banking is based in London. We have financial lawyers here. All the big accounting firms are here. We have the big fund management here. The insurance companies are here. The underwriting business of the world is here. We have a good currency. Our currency is not connected to the euro, which is fantastic. One of the smartest things we ever did is not join the euro, so that we are a separate entity
And the English language, I guess, is a big advantage.
The English language is huge because it has become the world's language, as is common law is also huge because common law is much more flexible commercial law, and often cross-border deals that are done not between Europe, but, you know, sort of a Brazilian company buying an Indian company, they will probably use English as the common language and common law.
Why was there such a big disconnect between what they said would happen and what has actually turned out to be the case? Was that partly a kind of an element of game theory with these banks, that they wanted us to stay in the EU and therefore have put out a kind of hysterical scenario? And was it a bit of project fear?
I suspect that there was an element of that. I mean, it's true that most bankers, it's not just that they think the interests of their banks are served better by remaining in the European Union. Being in the European Union does have costs, which I'm sure we'll get to. Mm. But their culture, partly it's just them as individuals. Most of them are kind of culturally metropolitan, and, you know, there's a strong correlation between that kind of background and being pro-Remain, as a matter of fact. So, I mean, you could just see it as simple as that. I'm not sure it really does serve their interests, but we'll get to that later, I guess.
I suspect there was a huge amount of that, actually. Large banks don't like change. Most of them have gone to great lengths to comply with the rulings and regulations of the EU. And for most large banks, once you have put that expense into setting up a new infrastructure project that complies with the law, does all the regulation, ticks all the boxes, they don't actually want to walk away from that. And that gives them a huge advantage over any new entrants into the market, because a new entrant would have to comply with all of that regulation. So I think there is that basic feeling of dislike of change, which is a natural thing within so many people, and especially people who are quite comfortably off and living quite nicely in the circumstances they find themselves in London. The idea that they might have to change is annoying to them, if you like. And also, I think that the people that they probably believe they could trust, such as the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the IMF and a lot of people who they rely on for forecasting, were all telling them that life would be bad after Brexit without them actually doing their own forecasts. I interview a lot of different bankers and people in financial institutions to see what they would like, what regulation they like about Brexit and what they would like to change. And almost all of them individually have told me that it doesn't really affect them that much. But it's incredible how the press managed to get hold of one or two large, mainly multinational banks who aren't even British-based and already have subsidiaries in Europe. All of the ones that screamed the loudest already had a subsidiary either in Paris or Germany or Ireland, or they were all quite well set up to absolutely float over Brexit without it worrying them. And yet they chose to join the Project Fear debate and claim that it would be a disaster for them and they'd all have to leave, which is just not true, in the same way that people are trying to make out that we will never trade with Europe after we leave. Well, that's also just not true. You know, we might, you know, it might be slightly slower to trade with Europe. We might have to pay a bit of import tax or something if we trade with Europe, but we will still trade with Europe. The same bankers that are not moving to Frankfurt are also not going to buy their BMW next year. You know, they just are. And it's completely disingenuous for them to ever have pretended that they were going to have to leave.
How much of a worry is that general resistance to change? Does that bode well for preparations for Brexit? If people who didn't see Brexit coming, didn't particularly want it, now have to adapt?
I think it bodes ill, because there's a risk that in order to make the transition as smooth as possible, and from a fear of disrupting trade with Europe, people will want to have a regulatory framework in Britain that mimics the one that we've got at the moment, so that we kind of leave the customs union, we leave the single market, but you wouldn't notice it if it weren't official. That's kind of what a lot of people are kind of trying to bring about, but then that makes Brexit entirely pointless. Whether you're for Brexit or against Brexit when you voted, it is happening, let's suppose. And given that it's happening, we want to take advantage of that. And how will we take advantage of that? Well, one way is by getting out from under the kind of regulatory fixation that is part of the EU model. I mean, they churn out regulation like you wouldn't believe, and we need to stop that. We need to get out of that. And I fear that a whole lot of people are going to say, no, we'll just go along with it all, as if we were still in the European Union, so that we can kind of get along with them. But we don't want to get along with them in that regard.
You would think that our entire country, our entire economy relied 100% on trade, and that 100% of trade happened with the EU. In reality, our economy has a huge internal market. The UK economy does not rely on trade. Trade is about 20%, I think, of the entire economy. Most of what we do is internal. And when we do trade, most of our trade is not with the EU. And in financial services, that is also the same. We do more financial services and insurance with the US than we do with Germany, France, and the Netherlands added together. And they are our three biggest markets in the EU by far. In fact, if you look at the latest ONS statistics for 2016, they haven't published 2017 yet, 9 of the EU countries don't even make the list of the top 50 export markets for financial services because we do less than £500,000 worth of business with them. To get onto the world's top 50, you need to do at least £500,000. Well, they're not even doing that much. Some of these markets are hugely unsophisticated. And the biggest problem, as Jamie points out, the EU love doing regulation, but they also like to do one-size-fits-all regulation, which generally fits no one. London is a hugely sophisticated global finance market, but we have the same regulation as Bratislava, or Prague, Riga, or places that have virtually no financial markets whatsoever. And as one banker did say to me, the way to deal with the EU is not to worry about the regulation, but to look at the flexibility of its implementation. He was European. That is the problem. The UK doesn't understand the flexibility of implementation. If it is written on the piece of paper, our PRA, FCA, Bank of England says, OK, that's what you have to do. And so that we then find ourselves competing with European markets where they're slightly more flexible in their approach to the regulation. And we don't have that. So we're potentially
a bit too overzealous in the way that we follow this regulation that exists. Other countries are not following it quite to the letter in the same way.
Well, in many of those countries, they don't even have the industries. So they don't have to worry about some of the regulation because they don't even have the underlying industry that it regulates. Many of the regulations have been developed by people who don't work in the industries and don't understand what's important and what isn't. I do believe most bankers in London will tell you of areas where our own FCA and PRA have been at the forefront of a lot of EU regulation of financial services. And I think that they were overzealous in some areas. But at the same time, they were developing regulation that was to cover a lot of different markets. And I believe that once they are only involved in covering the UK market, that gives them a huge ability to be more flexible. And so they will be able to adapt the regulation to suit the UK market.
What a lot of people fail to recognise, I think, is that market regulation can be generated privately. Suppose you start a stock exchange. You want to compete with the other stock exchanges in Europe, you'll have a bunch of rules for companies that want to list on your stock exchange, for people who want a seat there that they can buy and sell on the exchange. You'll require them to meet certain standards. That's just one example. This kind of thing happens everywhere. Those standards that you set, they're part of your offering. You might make them too strict, so people don't want to list on you anymore. It's too burdensome to list on your exchange. You might make them too lax, and investors don't want to buy securities from your exchange because they're not sure what they're getting. You can leave this stuff to the market, and then you will get competition between standards. You'll get variation in standards that change with the circumstances of the country, for example, as Catherine's been talking about. There's really no need to generate a set of rules that applies across the entire European Union to everybody. Take MiFID II. MiFID II aims to protect consumers, as part of it is to protect consumers in the investments industry, the buyers of securities. It has transparency requirements for the exchanges, for the people making, buying and selling. They've got to show what price they paid and so on. Well, transparency is a good like any other. Consumers want some transparency, but it costs money to supply it. And you might say, well, I'll have a little less security, a little less transparency, but at a lower price. There's no need for these things to be regulated again. If you've got a competitive market with very sophisticated participants in it, there's absolutely no need for these things to be handled outside of the market mechanism. And this is seems to be a kind of the problem with the European Union regulation. They don't even bother anymore to explain what market failure it is that they're remedying. They seem to think that things just stand in need of regulation always, and if they discover something that isn't regulated, that in itself calls for some action. Regulation is seen to be somehow intrinsically good. It's not something that's required to solve an identified market failure. It's just we haven't got a regulation there because we haven't had time yet, but we'll certainly get around to it sooner or later, especially now that, of course, you employ tens and tens of thousands of people working in regulatory agencies. When they finish with one thing, they just move on to the next. Not because there's any call to, just because, well, it's their job, isn't it?
MiFID II runs, I think, to well over a million paragraphs. I'm no regulator, but that just instinctively feels very excessive indeed.
It is incredibly excessive, and it is MiFID II. And to give you an idea of where this is going, in, say, the UCITS, which is about something that you or I would call shares or investments trusts, they have invented a new thing called a UCIT. We have UCIT 5 regulation, so having gone through UCIT 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5, and they're already working on UCIT 6 regulation. Oh, unfortunately, there's been massive unemployment in the EU, and Brussels has seen to fix this by employing more and more regulators. And this is about the only growth industry in regulation. And it has been pointed out in the City of London as well that the biggest growth area in the city in financial services at the moment is compliance officers, which is just a cost centre. They do not bring any new revenue into the bank. They are just compliance. Jamie is right. The EU have a tendency to regulate what they can rather than what needs to be regulated. The most obvious case of this is they decided to regulate the hedge fund industry, which doesn't really operate in the EU at all for various other regulatory problems. After the crash, the real reason for the financial crash in 2007-2008 was because the banks were overextended and had a lot of poor credit on their books. But that was too difficult to regulate because they didn't want to upset the banking industry anymore. So they decided to regulate the hedge funds, who had not caused the crash and had nothing to do with the crash. Most of them are operating out of the Cayman Islands and other non-EU domiciles. Most of their investors are in the US or in non-EU domiciles because the EU didn't allow hedge funds to sell directly into Europe. And even now they can't sell directly. So it was an area that had nothing to do with either the financial collapse of 2007-2008, and it had very little to do with the EU. And yet, the EU decided to introduce a whole layer of regulation around it. I was at a meeting last week, and people were complaining about MiFID II in terms of how it has affected the bond market, which the European bond market is their major investment market, because they have a tradition in the same way that the Anglo-Saxon markets have always dealt in equities. The Europeans have dealt in fixed income and bonds. The big problem with this market is illiquidity. There was something like 45,000 corporate bonds issued in Europe, of which 99% of them are illiquid, i.e. they don't trade. There are no bids, there are no offers. This is a major problem. If the bond market ever turns over, people will not be able to get out of their investments. However, the EU were not able to fix this, so they decided that they'd increase other areas of the bond market, like transparency and asking people to put every piece of information that they could possibly think of into computer systems, but the computer systems don't actually talk to each other, because unlike stocks that trade on a single stock exchange, the bond markets are often traded between buyers and sellers directly through a bank intermediary. Often the banks will take positions themselves. And as I said earlier, often they don't trade at all. And so the EU has developed a very complicated part of MiFID II is about the transparency of bonds, but they haven't fixed the liquidity of bonds. Liquidity of bonds will kill the market. Transparency won't, but they've fixed transparency, which I'm sure you'll be happy to hear.
So they're fighting the wrong battles.
They are always fighting the wrong battles. They don't understand the market well enough.
One big complaint, certainly in the business world, of EU regulation is that it seems to favour larger companies and multinationals over smaller ones and kind of helping the incumbents. And this is partly why leaving the EU seems to be more popular with SMEs than with larger companies. Do we see a similar picture in terms of the financial services regulation?
Well, that's an inevitable consequence of most regulations, because complying with regulations is to a large extent a fixed cost. So you've got to build a new computer system, you've got to bring in lawyers, all sorts of new staff who can check on compliance. And it doesn't really vary with the size of your operations. So it's a fixed cost, and whenever fixed costs go up, large players have an advantage because their unit costs go up by less. And so the entire regulatory agenda of the European Union favours large companies. And of course, large companies are the ones that have the ear of politicians and make all the noise, and you've heard all this. And so this is a kind of structural problem in a regulatory state, and we live in a regulatory state. And I see no signs of it going away, alas. But again, Brexit's a great opportunity, provided we take it.
What Jamie said is absolutely true, but the other side of it, for instance, under the MiFID regulation, MiFID I already asked for a lot more information about buyers, what's an appropriate investment for a private client. The data points that are needed for every sale have increased by 270% under MiFID II. So now there are 65 data points every time you trade. Now, a large company that has found it also easier to put in place the computer systems and the compliance officer is also more likely to deal with big pension funds or investors who will buy, a single investor will buy a large tranche of shares, say a million shares. So they will fill in this data of 65 points once. Where a smaller company that deals with private clients, he may have 1,000 private clients buying into the same tranche of shares. So they're all buying 1,000 shares each. They're still buying a million shares, but he has 65,000 lots of information to put into his computer system. So that he suddenly needs a much bigger computer system than a much bigger company who's dealing only with corporate investors and professional investors. So it's worse than just the fact that it's cheaper for a large company to comply. The smaller companies are often in a business that creates a greater requirement for data.
I can tell you a personal anecdote about this. My brother-in-law ran a commodities trading fund. It was very successful at points, but he never wanted it to become very big. He likes just working himself and a few people, and he quit the whole thing. He threw it all away, and I met him for lunch. This was a couple of years ago, and he said it's just becoming impossible to run a small fund because I can't comply with everything, and it's destroying my business. He couldn't really grow it that much, and he was just so fed up, he just left the whole industry. Of course, it's these small outfits often that are the source of innovation. They're the more dynamic firms. They're the ones with the new ideas. And, a different culture in big firms is always a bit stifling. And insofar as we make it life very, very difficult for small firms and startups, we're stifling innovation. I mean, politicians talk all the time about favouring small firms and innovation and so on, and then almost every action they take smashes small firms.
So the minimum requirement for starting a hedge fund today is £260 million under management, which basically eliminates so many small companies that could start up. I know of two very large hedge funds today that started with under £20 million in the 90s. People like that could not start today. The Treasury has put out a report that they want to make fund management into a kind of apprenticeship program. But if you look at all of the successful fund managers today in hedge funds, they often came out of working for other companies and left and set up their own firms. And they did that with a couple of clients. But now they would have to leave and take hundreds of millions of pounds worth of business with them to try and start another company. So it's really a business that is protecting the established firms. No one else will be able to get into that business.
So the situation that we are in presently seems to be a deeply, deeply dysfunctional one. What should be the areas that we really prioritise? In an ideal world, what would be the direction of travel once we've left the European Union?
What has been suggested by several people is that we introduce de minimis regulation. There are some areas of Britain where we do have a certain threshold where you have less regulation or maybe a lower tax structure or something that helps new companies grow. Singapore has been very forward in this, and they have tax regulation for new companies that lasts for the first 3 years of your life, and also tax regulation for small companies, so that small businesses that are never going to be particularly big also get similar tax deductions. I think that is a good way to go. I think we have to really look hard at what we are doing with the regulation, because we are driving small speculators and small investors out of the business, and yet they are the lifeblood of the liquidity of pretty much every market I've ever traded in. If we don't have small individual investors in the market, you will not get the liquidity that we saw in the 80s and the 90s, which really got these markets going in the first place.
Some financial regulation is international, so the Basel requirements, which specify how much capital banks need to hold, that's not a European piece of legislation or regulations. It comes from an international committee called the Basel Committee, and will remain signed up to that almost certainly. Some is local regulation or domestic regulation, but some is European. MiFID's European, that's why we've been talking about it. We have the chance to step out of it. We don't need to keep MiFID after we leave the European Union. That would be something we should certainly do. There are some other crazy regulations that come out of Europe. One was the way bankers are paid. There's a rule that a banker's bonus cannot be greater than his salary. That's crazy. The effect of that, I don't need to explain to people who listen to the IEA, was that salaries went up immediately. It used to be that you got a pretty small salary and you hoped to get a big bonus. That was the model of investment banker pay. And it was very sensible because it meant that as the investment bank did badly, let's say, how much it paid its staff went way down because you didn't have to pay any bonuses. You were just stuck with the low fixed salaries. By shifting to this new system, which was designed amusingly to reduce risk, the banks fixed their stable pay expenses, went up massively, so that in a downturn, their costs don't move down with them. What you want to avoid risk is that your revenues and your costs vary together. If they vary together, you don't have any risk. If you've got fixed costs and variable revenues, you've got a lot of risk. And this rule moved banks in that direction. So there's another thing we could get out of, and there are other things in asset management that you told me about, Catherine.
Well, actually, I'd like to start first with the, as you rightly say, Basel III is something that the world is complying with. However, Basel III is only for banks that are trading internationally. It's for internationally active banks. The EU decided to adopt it for all of their banks because technically any EU financial company can trade in another EU country, hence internationally. Therefore, we have very small banks and completely local banks, even your Leicester Building Society, if such a thing exists, have to comply with Basel III, which is completely stupid. I wouldn't get rid of MiFID, but I would certainly tear up half of it and throw it away. There are some good things in all of this regulation, but there's far too much of it, it's far too complicated, and it's not actually achieving the outcomes. We have to really look at what we're trying to achieve with the regulation and make that work, rather than pages and pages of regulation, which often turns out to be a box-ticking exercise which protects the bank rather than the investor. Because the bank can say, well, we decided that this was appropriate for this guy. We did that box. We asked him these questions. We ticked all of those boxes. Therefore, it's his problem, not our problem. So a huge amount of EU regulation protects the company rather than the customer. The other area where there's a lot that could be fixed is insolvency too, which is a great piece of legislation. It's useful. However, again, it misses a lot of areas. The insurance companies in Britain are famous throughout the world for providing unusual insurance, catastrophe insurance, airline insurance, marine insurance. A whole lot of things are happening in London. And yet the Solvency II in its best EU one size fits all is really geared around things like life insurance and house insurance, driver's insurance, things that they have very good statistics on. And so they put a lot of weight onto the stats that are available. Unfortunately, the British have been very good at doing insurance on things that have ridiculous stats or no stats, or you know, once every 10 years a hurricane wipes out Haiti or whatever, that sort of stats. And they are not reliable statistically, and they really cannot fall under the Solvency II banner the same way that the EU expects them to. There are a lot of areas that for the British market, we are doing different things from the EU market, and we have to be able to have different regulation for those areas.
But, Catherine, isn't it even sillier than that? I mean, Solvency II specifies the way insurers need to measure their risk and how to capitalise to cover it. But that's what insurance is.
Yes.
That's what insurers do.
Yes.
And a good insurer will be better at that than a bad insurer, and they compete on that, and they find better ways of measuring risk and so on. And that is the essence of the business. And Solvency II comes in and says, no, we'll tell you how to do your business.
Well, it's
bonkers. And there was no particular problem it was solving.
That's true.
Where was the problem with insurers and their capitalization? Where was the crisis in the insurance industry that led to this? I mean, AIG was somewhat involved in the financial crisis because it had written all those CDOs, right? This credit default swaps. Not CDO, CDS. But that's not really the normal insurance business. That in a way, they'd stepped out of sight of doing insurance in the normal sense of insurance. There was no issue. This is a classic case of regulation for the sake of it, and also a classic case of innovation stifling, because they are setting rules about what ought to be kind of design features of this business. It's as if they regulated car manufacturing and said, cars have all got to be like this. And they described the way cars must be made, what they must look like. And it's actually hijacked the industry. The perverse thing is, having done this, taxpayers will be on the hook if an insurer becomes insolvent, because it's a side effect of this regulatory approach. Suppose you say, well, I'm an insurer. I'm just complying with the rules specified by the state. They were supposed to be sufficient for solvency. Now there's been a problem. Well, who's responsible? It's the state that's responsible. And so who will pay it up? It'll be taxpayers. So this actually shifts liability from voluntary investors in insurance companies to taxpayers.
I agree 100% that they solved a problem that wasn't a problem. And they certainly have made it much more difficult for a lot of business that ran out of the UK. Ridiculous is probably the word I'm looking for.
What I'm hearing a lot in all of this is that the regulatory response to the financial crisis was to kind of punish some of the wrong people. But on the flip side, I think that's going to be quite difficult to overcome, because I think a lot of the British public certainly is quite relaxed about this sector being heavily regulated, because there is still a lot of resentment about the financial crisis. Do you think that is fair to say? And if so, how does one overcome that?
By stealth. That's to say, politically, I agree, it would be quite difficult for a politician to be seen to be lightening the burden on the banking industry. For example, the balance sheet tax, that really probably should be removed. It would be, I think, a brave politician who removed it. But a lot of these things can be done quietly. I mean, the truth of the matter is that most members of the public and most journalists don't have much appetite for discussing financial regulation.
Reading through all 1.7 million paragraphs of it.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, after Brexit in particular, there's so much going on that you don't need to make a fuss about it. It could just be done.
Well, I think that people have to be reminded as to how much banks involve the local economy. And the bank levy, which was to rein in the whole bank balance sheet, has been replaced with a bank surcharge. And the surcharge is a tax on profits. It has nothing to do with the size of your balance sheet. So the surcharge is taxing the profitable banks so that this money can go into general revenue, but the excuse is it is there to prop up the unprofitable banks. Well, we used to actually have a thing that did this, and it was called the free market, but we won't go there. The real issue is that by requiring all banks to hold more capital than is strictly necessary, you're actually restricting the amount of capital that's available for lending. So the first people that don't get or get refused for a mortgage may complain because the good old village building society doesn't have enough money to lend out for mortgages. And the best person to judge whether local people can buy local houses is going to be a local bank or building society who knows, hopefully, the people, but certainly the local market, and they will know the real value. But if they're restricted by how much they can lend because they have to hold more capital than they used to have to hold, then that does eventually affect the whole market. And it's not just housing, it's also for local businesses. They don't have the ability to lend as much as they did before. It does affect the whole economy.
So we need to make that case.
This is a nice point again about small businesses. It's an indirect path to hurting them, but the increased capital requirements that were imposed after the crisis and the rules about how you measure the risk of the person you're lending to meant that it became very unattractive for banks to lend to small businesses because they had to hold a lot of capital in reserve against those loans. So they've only got two things they can do in that case. One is restrict lending to small businesses or charge the small businesses much more for those loans, which, by the way, is politically difficult because you get in trouble for that. So they just don't lend to small businesses. Small businesses have been complaining ever since the crisis that they can't get credit. And this is partly the result of these banking rules. So yet again, the rules hurt the little guy.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.